Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. In recent months, dead gray whales, sick and starving sea lions and seals on California beaches has raised serious concerns about the health of our oceans and the challenges marine mammals face. The impacts of the climate crisis are becoming more destructive and evident. In June, thousands of mussels cooked to death in their shells at Bodega Head, which is 60 miles north of San Francisco. In 2015, the news of thousands of Dungeness crabs containing potentially fatal levels of domoic acid prompted state officials to ban fishing and the consumption of Dungeness crabs. This year, the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, California, has rescued 370 sick and starving California sea lions, 207 of them in June alone. In addition, so far this year, 103 gray whales have been found dead on California beaches. So what is behind this dramatic influx of dead or sick and starving marine mammals, and what's being done to save them? Today, we're joined by two guests in studio. Dr. Sean Johnson is director of the veterinary science at the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito, a nonprofit dedicated to the rescue and rehabilitation of ill and injured marine mammals. And if you are in the area, you can take a tour of the incredible work that the team at the Marine Mammal Center does. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you.
Great to have you. Mo Flannery is the Bird and Mammals Collection Manager at the California Academy of Sciences. It's an incredible science museum and scientific and educational institution located in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. Hi, Mo. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, I want to start off by asking you both a very basic question. We're talking about mussels being cooked to death, Dungeness crabs containing fatal levels of domoic acid. This was in 2015. We've got sick and starving sea lions, gray whales found dead on California beaches. Mo, have we seen anything like this before in California?
So in the past, we have seen some years similar to this year, especially for gray whales in 1999 and 2000. So about 20 years ago, there was a large die-off of gray whales, and we're seeing something very similar. So we're working to investigate that along with the Marine Mammal Center.
Sean? Have we seen anything like this before with sea lions?
Over, you know, the Marine Mammal Center has been responding to animals here in California over 44 years now, I think, and we've seen large years in previous years when there's been oceanographic changes, increase in water temperature, large El Ninos, the blah back in 2015. But these events, these warm water events, these abnormalities are happening. They appear to be happening more frequently and more often, especially more recently. And so this year was another small El Nino that was declared by NOAA, but it had huge. It seems like these ocean temperature changes are having huge increases on the animals right here off our coast.
Can you elaborate on that? Can you tell us what we know about how warming oceans is affecting these animals?
Well, as the ocean temperatures increase, it changes the entire ecosystem, where the fish live, where they, you know, increases in algal blooms, which create the domoic acid. There is ocean acidification. All these changes have impacts on the marine mammals that live in these nearshore environments. And basically, the marine mammals are the canary of the ocean. They are the top predators. They're the ones that really give us an indication when there's a problem in the environment in the ocean.
In 2017, oceanographers at UC Davis found that average ocean temperatures off the California coast have increased gradually over the past century, recently surpassing 65 degrees Fahrenheit near San Diego and 55 degrees in the north of the state. So, Mo, what would you add about the ocean warming and how that's connected to what we're seeing?
Well, I think it's one of the questions that we're asking. So I'm particularly involved with this unusual mortality event with gray whales. And gray whales have a very interesting life history strategy where they currently, right now, the gray whales are all in Alaska. And they're feeding up in Alaska. That's what they do during the summertime. And then they migrate south down to Baja, California, Mexico, to reproduce and give birth in over the winter. And then they head back to Alaska. Now, the only time that they really feed is when they're up in Alaska. That's their designated feeding time. If climate change is a key factor in what's affecting them, researchers need to look at where the whales are feeding. Are they moving up and down the the water column to find food? Are they having trouble finding food? Do they have to move more farther north? And those are some of the questions that we're working on with this large investigative team. So we don't know for sure yet, but the food on the feeding ground is one possibility.
Can you talk more about how these investigations operate? I understand that these current investigations, looking at why so many gray whales are dying, will take years.
It will take a while. So there are currently three on the West Coast, three unusual mortality events. You're called UMEs, and they're designated by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And they determine when animals have died, if there's a higher than usual number of deaths, then they designate an unusual mortality event. And then that brings researchers together. So here for the gray whale UME, which just started in this spring, we're working with the Marine Mammal Center, with all the California nonprofit stranding agencies, with folks in Canada, Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and Mexico. So the government is basically bringing together all these scientists, people who work with live whales, studying them in the wild, and then people who work with the dead whales on the beaches like us here. There's a California sea lion UME that's been going on for several years, and then there's also one on Guadalupe fur seals in our area here in California. So those ongoing UMEs are an indicator that it does take a while for us to gain the evidence that we need to determine what's happening to these animals.
Most of us have seen the horrible video of a dead whale washed ashore with a lot of people taking photos, and then the investigators show up to do their important work. What should people do if they run across a dead whale?
Definitely call it in. So you can call it in to the Marine Mammal Center. They have someone on the phones all the time. You can send photos to their rescue line. And then once a phone call comes in, that's when the entire team gets activated. So we're really unique in this area that the Marine Mammal Center and the California Academy of Sciences work together on all of these large whales. It would be really hard for each organization, because we're small organizations, to be able to bring a team of people together to do a whale necropsy, which takes a large team. Usually we have 12 to 18 people, depending on the size of the whale. So we work as a great team, trying to figure out when can we go, how do we get there, how do we get the people, how do we, you know, talk to the media, control the crowd. All of that comes into play.
And Sean, can you talk about what is involved in rescuing sick and starving sea lions?
Yeah, yes. The Marine Mammal Center's rescue range extends from San Luis Obispo County all the way up to Fort Bragg, 600 miles of the coastline, and it's quite a lot of beaches and area for us to respond to. So we have staff and volunteers up and down the whole coast. Our headquarters is here in Sausalito, but we have a triage center in Moss Landing and another one in Morro Bay, where we have small centers of staff and volunteers. We have a 24-hour hotline. So, and we encourage anyone who sees a marine mammal that is in distress or looks like it might need help to give us a call at our hotline. And then that activates an assessment or response, where we will send our experts of volunteers and staff out to the beach to assess if the animal needs to be picked up or maybe assisted in any way, or maybe it's just an elephant seal that's resting, and we'll put up a sign and to keep people away. And that whole process, you know, we try to respond as quickly as we can in a safe way for all the people involved. If an animal needs to be rescued, our team usually will have the right equipment, nets, boards, kennels to capture the seal, sea lion, bring it to our triage center, or bring it directly here to Sausalito, and to get the assessment, to get the veterinary exam. And then animals that are at the edges of our range are transported to our main hospital here in Sausalito, where they will get their continued medical treatments and rehabilitation. That's also where we try to understand why they stranded in the first place, and that's really one of the most important parts of this whole process is these animals should be healthy. They should be out in their ecosystem, being thriving. And if they're washing up on our beaches, why? What's the problem? What can we do to help? to, you know, to try to find all those answers.
How do you go about trying to find those answers? What's that process like?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a combination of collecting data of all different kinds, the location of where the animal strands and potentially what's happening around that location is the first indicator. Then doing blood work, trying to make a diagnosis. Sometimes it's easy. They have an entanglement around their neck that's preventing them from foraging. Mm. Sometimes it's really we have a difficult time understanding why an animal stranded and potentially if we have to euthanize them or if they die during treatment, then we do a full necropsy just like we do on the beaches with the whales, where we can collect tissue samples and get more data. And that's when we might find cancer in California sea lion or ingestion of a foreign object that caused them to die or something like that. So it's a huge process where we have veterinarians, pathologists, biologists to collect all the data that we can get together and then collaborate with all our partners to try to understand why that animal stranded.
Do you know why these animals get cancer?
Well, our California sea lions have a very high rate of cancer here in California. We're trying to better understand why, but through the research over the years, through the Marine Mammal Center and other collaborators and scientists, it looks like there's three issues here. One of them is that the sea lions that have cancer tend to be more closely related, so there's a genetic component there. But more importantly, it looks like there is a virus, a herpes virus, that is causing the cancer. And then the animals potentially who are getting the cancer, like why aren't all sea lions getting cancers? Well, they look like there might be a genetic component, and then there's probably a pollution, a toxin component to that as well. And we're right in the middle of continuing to better understand that correlation between all those three causes.
Does anything strike you about the ages of these sea lions, or is it a wide range?
The age of the sea lions that get cancer is very interesting. The youngest animal we found is 4 years old, which was a young female that had urogenital carcinoma. So this is a carcinoma in the reproductive tract. It's very invasive. Once the virus gets in there and starts creating the cancer, then it metastasizes. And by the time we see the animals, it's fully metastasized, and there's nothing that we can do from a treatment perspective. Mm-hmm. But about 26% of all the adult California sea lions that we rescue have some stage of cancer. It's really the highest rate of cancer in a wild animal, except for the Tasmanian devil in Australia that has a very interesting type of cancer as well that's spread from devil to devil. So it's a big problem for the sea lions.
Did you have cancer data, say, 15, 20 years ago?
We have yes.
And I just wonder, is it different? Is it worse now?
Well, this is a good question. You know, the center has been around for 44 years or so, but it's been the last 20, 25 years where we have started to focus on the science and the data and understanding why these animals are stranding. But I believe we have evidence of cancer back more than 20 years ago.
How do you determine the age of sea lions?
Well, it can be difficult sometimes. One of the things is there's dimorphism in the sex. And so as the adults, males are bigger and they have a crest, then the females. And so adults are pretty easy to tell apart. When they're young, it's quite a bit harder to tell between a juvenile and, a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old or something like that. You can take a tooth and slice it, and you can count the rings. And each year, it's like a tree. And so as we do science and as we collect tissues in necropsy, we'll collect a tooth and so that we can determine the exact age.
And what about the age of gray whales? How do you determine that?
That's an interesting question, too. We mostly go by size, and there's some debates within the community of what size is, how old are they and what size are they when they wean. So we standardize that as best we can, but it's mostly by size and reproductive status. So once we do a necropsy, we can see whether it's an adult female or not.
Do gray whales get cancer?
Not that I know of. I haven't heard of any that we've found or any tissues that have been sent in that have come back that way. Mm. But we will not leave any stone unturned. So
right.
Those are good questions to ask.
Today it is our One Planet series, and we're talking about why so many marine mammals are dying and getting sick and starving on California beaches. And today we're joined by Dr. Sean Johnson, Director of Veterinary Science at the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito. They're dedicated to the rescue and rehabilitation of ill and injured marine mammals. And if you're in the area, you can take a tour of the center, and you can actually watch, we'll talk about this later, but you can watch the seals and sea lions being rehabilitated. It's actually a really amazing place with a lot of education. It's a great place to take kids. We're also joined by Mo Flannery. She is the Bird and Mammals Collection Manager at the California Academy of Sciences, another amazing place for kids and adults. It's a science museum and a scientific and educational institution located in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests about what's happening to these animals, we'd love to hear from you. I'm sure you've seen the TV footage of the dead whales or the rehabilitation of sea lions. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And I also just want to acknowledge the horrific ongoing gun violence that's happening in this country. Last week, we added a segment to the end of our show. This time we decided to continue with our regularly scheduled programming, and we will have a series of shows about gun violence in the coming days. You know, I feel like when we see dead whales, or if we hear about starving sea lions, we all want to point to climate change because the average person probably doesn't remember that this may have happened before. And I wonder what you both think of that. Just given the fact that the oceans are warming and for some animals it's harder to find food, things are just, I remember going whale watching, I believe it was last year, and we didn't know where to look because there was so much activity, because there was a lot of food near the shore, and it was just an amazing spectacle. And so I think a lot of people say this is the climate crisis, this is why it's happening. What are your thoughts on that, Sean?
It's a challenging question because climate is such a big issue and it affects the whole earth. And we're focused right here locally in California. But when we talk about, we've seen events like this in the past where we've seen large numbers of stranded animals, it's almost always been related to fluctuations in the ocean and abnormalities in ocean temperature, like very large El Nino events, which are naturally occurring events, have caused mass mortalities. In the past, 2009, we had huge numbers of sea lions strand in May and June because of an El Nino event. 1998. What I think we're seeing is that the variability, the changes are happening very rapidly, and we're just not able to keep up from a standpoint of understanding what's happening on a larger scale.
And why is that? What explains that? Just because there's so much going on?
Well, as Mo said, we have three active UMEs going on right now. These are unusual mortality events where we haven't been able to determine why these animals are stranding and dying, and that there's all these ongoing investigations into it. And I think the ocean is, such a large area that we still know very little about. But we do know that the marine mammals are really indicators of ocean health. And as we see more and more of these events happening, we need to be very concerned about the environment that they are coming from.
What would you add, Mo?
I would say that climate change is probably a piece of the puzzle, and we don't want to forget about something else. So if there's a disease or something out there that we're missing, we want to do a complete investigation to make sure that's not the case. Or maybe it's the combination of both. So there are lots of questions, and certainly ocean health plays a big role in it, and it may multiply the effects of something like a disease or migration status or population size might all be affected by climate change. But we're still We don't want to forget anything.
Right. And what would you say about the fact that because the ocean is warming and we're seeing just bizarre patterns happening, the way that animals are eating is changing. I mean, these are all factors, and it seems like it's all happening so quickly, right? So how does that determine, how does that factor into your investigations?
I think it would be really interesting to look at some species that are able to move more and follow the food and how they're doing compared to other species that are more restricted in their feeding. So like humpback whales, they can go wherever the food supply is. So if the food is moving different from this year than last year, they can move to that area. Whereas young sea lions have a more difficult time finding food foraging. So it does seem like it's happening faster, and maybe if we look at all the different species together and their lifestyles and their life history, we can determine that.
Well, one of the important jobs for Mo and I are to collect the data to be able to, you know, Mo goes out on the beaches and helps collect data from the dead animals. We bring in the live animals and try to understand why they're stranding. This is all very important information that will help us answer that question, is what is causing this increase in marine mammal strandings, and what can we potentially do about it?
Well, let's go to a caller before we go to break. Let's hear from Kit in San Rafael. Hi, Kit. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yes. Kit, if you can turn your radio off. Hi, Kit. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead. We can hear you. Hello, Kit?
Yeah.
Hi, you're on the air.
I wanted to say, aren't there common threads between the stranding of sea lions and seabirds, because they're both subject to climate change and change in the depths of the prey they feed on, as well as some problems with fishing, like the collapse of the sardine population, which is affecting both like sea lions and shorebirds.
Thank you. Sean?
That is true. Often we see corresponding mortality events in seabirds that correspond with what we're seeing in the marine mammals. They're both eating and relying on the same food source. So if we see a large domoic acid event where sea lions are washing up on our beaches with neurologic disease and having seizures, we often, not we, but the folks that take care of the bird side, see brown pelicans and pelicans with the same kind of neurologic disease, because they're eating the same fish that have the toxin in them.
Yeah, and sometimes the birds are an indicator a little bit earlier than the marine mammals. So for the past couple of years, there have been some small die-offs of Cassin's auklets and common MERS, but they happen earlier in the season. So then that kind of gives us an idea we better be ready. There may be something affecting the sea lions coming up very shortly afterwards. And I think it does indicate that we need to be more conscientious about the fisheries and how much we're fishing and what's available for the animals too as well.
Thank you so much for that, Kit. In fact, after the break, we will talk about the Pacific sardine collapse. Today, we are talking about why so many whales are dying and why we're seeing so many sick and starving sea lions and seals on California beaches. We're joined by Dr. Sean Johnson, Director of Veterinary Science at the Marine Mammal Center, and Mo Flannery, Birds and Mammals Collection Manager at the California Academy of Sciences. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we decided to change the show to focus on the epidemic of gun violence in the United States. The Gun Violence Archive has reported 255 mass shootings in the United States so far this year. So we're going to talk about what we know about the radicalization of young white male shooters, White supremacy and the connections to Donald Trump's racist rhetoric. What can we do about this epidemic of violence? And I have to be honest, whenever these happen, we just talk amongst ourselves and say, how should we cover this? So if you have any angle ideas or guest ideas around the epidemic of gun violence in this country, we would love to hear from you. Please email yourcall@kalw.org. And we decided to continue with today's regular show because this issue is very, very important, and we are going to spend many days this week talking about gun violence. But if you'd like to join today's show about why we are seeing dead gray whales and sick and starving sea lions and seals on California beaches, we'd love to hear from you. Yourcall@kalw.org. You can also give us a call at 866-798-8255. And we're talking about this with Mo Flannery, the Birds and Mammals Collection Manager at the California Academy of Sciences. It's a science museum and scientific and educational institution in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park. And Dr. Sean Johnson, Director of Veterinary Science at the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito. They're dedicated to the rescue and rehabilitation of ill and injured marine mammals. And Kit brought up the sardine collapse. And I wanted to just quickly talk about this because it's really important. And I'm just reading here from Oceana.org. It says, Pacific sardine numbers are crashing and overfishing continues to be a major threat. In 2006, there were more than 1.8 million metric tons of sardines. In 2019, there were 27,000 metric tons. So, I mean, this is just a major crash. And according to KQED, this is from April, West Coast regulators have voted unanimously to ban commercial sardine fishing for the fifth straight year after a recent evaluation of the Northern Pacific stock revealed a steep decline. This is a sardine catch ban the entire length of the U.S. West Coast. So this was huge. I mean, this actually has happened the last couple of years. But what can you tell us about this, Sean, and the significance of this collapse and how it's affecting marine life?
I don't know a lot about the fishing industry, especially the sardine industry, but the collapse of the sardine or this fisheries did correspond with the increased number of sea lion strandings, especially back in 2015. These small fish, sardines, anchovies, herring, are very important to the sea lion population, all the marine mammal pinniped population here in California. They're one of their primary food sources. So anything that impacts or decreases the food availability, especially to the younger animals when they're recently weaned from their mothers, it's going to have an impact on their ability to survive.
How old are they when they're weaned from their moms?
For the California sea lions, they're about 11 months old. So most of the sea lions are born down on the Channel Islands off of Southern California. Their mothers forage a few days offshore, mostly on sardines, anchovies, herrings, these kind of fish, come back and then nurse their pups for a day or two and then go back out and forage and to feed and produce more milk. That cycle happens over about 10 months, and then in about 10, 11 months, then they wean the pup. This young animal who has very little experience then goes out in the ocean and has to find fish that they can catch. They're not very big. They can't dive very deep, and these feeder fish are one of their primary sources of food.
And at 11 months, at that point, are they then on their own?
Yeah, they're completely on their own at that point, and that's when they start to migrate north. Most of the sea lions then come north in the summertime where there's more food off the coast here, and that's if they're unable to find enough food, that's when we start seeing these sick and starving sea lions washing up on our beaches like we did this June.
Let's go to another caller. Let's hear from Daisy in San Francisco. Hi, Daisy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, yes. I know that the show is focusing on sort of the Pacific marine life crisis going on, but I read recently about the right whales dying off in sort of the North Atlantic shipping corridors off of Canada, and I was wondering what the speakers could talk to in terms of how what's going on with California relates on a global scale, if they see any other trends that relate to what's going on in, like, the Atlantic Ocean and the Indian Ocean, and how it's all connected.
Thank you. Mo?
So the northern right whales are a different situation than the West Coast animals that we're seeing. Their numbers are very low. I think there's only about 500 of them. So any time that one northern right whale dies, in the wild along the East Coast, there's a major response to learn as much as possible from that animal and to prevent it as much as possible. We're doing similar work here in the West Coast as far as the shipping industry goes. And that is ships are being encouraged to slow down coming into San Francisco Bay, and they're doing very similar things along the East Coast in Boston and ports further north, because shipping hazards can be one of the major contributors to large whale deaths, and they do see that often with the northern right whale.
And what about entanglement? The Guardian reports that the abrupt increase in mortality is believed to be caused, as you said, by boat strikes and entanglements in fishing gear caused by changes in the whale's feeding patterns.
So the entanglement is a big issue on both coasts. There are teams on each coast that try and rescue entangled whales and disentangle them. Those working with the fisheries and with the industry has been a major component on both coasts as well. So here on the West Coast, NOAA is working with crab fisheries to look at different ways to build nets that might release or ropes that wouldn't entangle a whale. Because part of the problem with the Dungeness crab fishery is the timing of the fishery changes with the domoic acid outbreaks and the closures, and then it's a much more concentrated time period, and so there are more traps in the water, so there's more chances of whales getting entangled. And on the East Coast, it's lobster fishing, and there's a lot of research going on right now to try and develop and design different traps that are less likely to entangle large whales.
The Guardian reports that this June, 6 right whales were killed, followed by 2 more in July. And then what else can be done about entanglements in California? Because in 2018, at least 45 whales were found entangled, which is more than quadruple the annual average before 2014. This is according to Kristen Monself, who works at the Center for Biological Diversity.
I think working with the fisheries industry is a first step. Reporting and responding as quickly as possible are probably second steps. So if anyone's out on the water and they see an entangled whale, definitely call it in as quickly as you can. Try and keep eyes on the whale. There's an entanglement team that goes up and down the coast. When a whale is entangled, they'll put buoys on it to try and keep track of it. And then they're often very successful when they can get out there to disentangle the whale. So first we need to really make changes in the fisheries apparatus and the equipment, and then we want to try and rescue and disentangle as many as we can.
What we've seen, there's been a large increase in the number of entangled whales here on the West Coast over the past couple of years, and one of the theories is that it's because the fish have changed where they are because of changes in the ocean conditions, and that has put whales in the same areas where the crab fisheries is, thus increasing the likelihood of entanglement. So, it's all these changes are happening and creating these risks. There's increased number of whales which is a great thing. Mm-hmm. There's whales in San Francisco that hadn't been here forever, and they're back, and you can see them right off the Golden Gate Bridge. That also means that they're interacting with this crab fisheries that's been here forever too. So it's really a management issue to be able to continue the fisheries and understand why the whales are here and how, when they come, and how to prevent them from interacting, and then also coming up with new techniques for fishing that will be safer for the whales. And the Marine Mammal Center is part of the whale entanglement team here locally, and just in the last week there were 2 reported entangled whales in the Monterey area that we were unable to mount a full response and disentangle that whale. So hopefully those whales will be seen again soon so that we can hopefully help them.
Well, thanks again for the call, Daisy. Let's go next to Sarah calling from Sausalito. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. I am a master gardener in Los Angeles County, and I'm here at the Headlands visiting right now. And I'm listening to the conversation about, to come back to the cancer present in the sea lions. And it's reminiscent to me of plant pathology, which is what's there's something called the disease triangle. There has to be the susceptibility there, which is the proclivity to cancer that's genetic. There also has to be the pathogen there, which is the virus that Dr. Johnson brought up. But there also has to be a reduced immune ability there, so the conditions for this to happen. And I'm wondering, when you're thinking about animals and mammals that move so much, how can you knock out that third aspect of the disease triangle, or at least monitor it and mitigate it?
It's really interesting. I didn't know that there were similar types of pathology and diseases in plants that would cause this, but this is, that's exactly what we're investigating. You know, we have evidence of the herpes virus, the genetic, and really the next step is try to understand how these pollutants that were put into the environment years and years and years ago are being accumulated in the marine, these long living animals. And it takes these pollutants a really, really long time to decrease levels and dissipate. And it's a continuing, ongoing question that we're hoping to understand, because what we're learning about the marine mammals here, this triad that's causing this disease, it's the same in humans. We're consuming the same, you know, lots of us are consuming the same fish, the same type of products that these sea lions are eating right now.
And what pollutants are you most concerned about?
Most of these are the ones that were put out a long time ago, the DDTs and DTEs, mm-hmm. that are very long persistent in the environment.
Well, thank you for calling in, Sarah. We have a couple of whale questions. Philip writes, have your guests identified the cause of death for the humpback whale that washed ashore this spring at Fort Funston on Ocean Beach in San Francisco?
I don't recall a humpback whale in, did they say in the fall?
Let's see, it's in the spring.
In the spring. Yeah, so this spring, we have, the Marine Mammal Center and the California Academy of Sciences together have responded to 15 dead whales. That's basically between San Mateo and Mendocino County. One was a humpback, and that was back in January. And then the rest were all gray whales. We did actually, a couple of weeks ago, have two small humpbacks in Point Reyes National Seashore, one of which we couldn't access because of the tides, and the other one did show injuries consistent with trauma, blunt force trauma, consistent with a ship strike. But I don't recall a humpback whale in the spring.
I just searched, and the Chronicle has a piece from September that says what was left of a humpback whale measured 32 feet long.
Right. So there was parts of a humpback that washed up in the fall of last year. And the Fort Funston area is really interesting because when an animal washes up down there, it tends to stay there for a very long time. So those were parts from a whale from earlier in the year. And I'd have to look that up to know specifically what the cause of death was. But for four or five months over winter, you'll see parts of animals washing up all along Daly City, Fort Funston area.
Well, thank you for the email, Philip. If you'd like to take part in the conversation, if you have any questions or comments for our guests, Mo Flannery is Birds and Mammals Collection Manager at the California Academy of Sciences, and Dr. Sean Johnson is Director of Veterinary Science at the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito. Today we're talking about dead gray whales, sick and starving sea lions and seals, and what explains this. You can email yourcall@kalw.org. You can also give us a call, 866-798-8255. Another question about whales from Paul. How does the use of loud sonar affect whales, and is the military still using sonar?
I believe the military is still using sonar. We don't really see that in our area because most of the military activities are farther south in Southern California. But there are alerts that go out to the marine mammal stranding community, and we're all part of a larger network that's all along the coast of the U.S. called the Marine Mammal Stranding Network. So reports do go out ahead of time, alerts to let people know when there is sonar testing, to keep an eye out. And when animals do strand with sonar testing, there's some Sean can talk more about this, but live cetaceans, when they strand, you can do hearing tests. And dead animals, it's harder to determine, but people do look into that down there.
It's, as Mo said, in this area, it's very rare that we have seen, well, I don't know if we've ever seen any direct impacts from sonar testing in this area, but we are prepared if an animal strands and we know that there's sonar activity in the area to take the right samples and do the right diagnostics to see if it was potentially caused by the effects of sonar.
Paul also says, how about making fishers use lines that sink to the bottom and an airbag that inflates on command using a remote?
That's a good idea. I'll pass that along to the folks who are working with the fisheries. Any idea is helpful.
Thank you for that. If you have any idea or any questions or comments, you can join us 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. I wanted to ask you, Sean, when you bring in sick and starving sea lions to the Marine Mammal Center for rehabilitation, I mean, this is what people can actually see from a deck. And you can look below and see the sea lions in these little pools. What is that process like? I mean, how do you determine what the sea lion actually needs? Because I've been there and I brought my niece, and it's really an amazing thing to see. But that was the question I had, is how do they know what treatment the sea lion needs?
Well, so the Marine Mammal Center is a hospital for animals. They just happen to be marine mammals. So we take all the same type of steps that you would if you took your dog to the vet or if you went to the hospital. The first step is to diagnose the problem. And if it's just a starving sea lion that needs more nutrition, then we will provide them with food. Often when they're extremely sick, they won't eat on their own because they're just too ill, they're too weak. And so we have a whole team of animal care volunteers and staff who create what we call a milkshake, a fish shake. You know, we grind up herring and add water, vitamins, electrolytes, and we go out and they go out and to feed them to get them the nutrients they need. And as they get stronger, then we start offering them frozen fish in their pools with the ultimate goal of getting them up to a healthy weight and free of disease so that we can release them back out in the wild and they can forage on their own and continue to thrive. The harder part is that is when they come in with these diseases, domoic acid, cancer, parasites, overloads, entanglements, and trying to determine how we can treat those diseases. And so then we can give them medications, we can do surgery, we bring in specialists to help us if they have eye problems. We have an ophthalmologist that comes in, and we're a full service hospital for marine mammals with veterinarians, veterinary technicians, and over 1,300 volunteers that help provide the care and cleaning for all the animals, which it's just a really incredible that we are able to help these animals with such a little amount of resources that we have.
It's an amazing operation. Mm-hmm. Do you tag the sea lions once you release them back into the ocean to monitor how they're doing? And how do you monitor that?
Well, every animal that is released gets a tag, a little orange tag on a flipper tag. And that doesn't allow us to track them. But if they become resighted or they restrand, then that information is collected. We know where that animal had been, at least went for its original treatment. For some special species, we can add special tags that will track their movements and their dive patterns, either linked to the satellite, and we can glue them to these tags to their hair, and they can give us windows into their life after we release them, usually only a few months because the battery life dies, they molt, the tags fall off. But with species such as Guadalupe fur seals that we know nothing about really, because no one's really studied them and their population numbers are finally starting to increase and we're seeing more of them, we'll put a tag on them when we release them, a satellite tag, so we can see where they go, because no one knows where they go or where they eat or where they spend their time. And this information is really important to understand how to continue to conserve a species like the Guadalupe fur seal that only lives in Mexico and reproduces on this little teeny island off of Baja.
Well, let's hear from another caller. Let's go to Meredith in Mill Valley. Hi, Meredith. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I understood from a documentary film that there's a whole ecosystem that grows under the floating sea ice. The algae and then the little critters, the krill, I presume, is among those that the gray whale feeds on. And if the sea ice is melting, perhaps that's why the gray whales are weak, because they don't have enough krill to eat anymore.
So there are researchers that are looking into that as we speak. So they're up there in Alaska monitoring where the gray whales are, how much they're feeding, where they're feeding, if they're further north than they have been in the past. And so we'll know more after this summer feeding season is over, and they can measure in the water where these guys feed on amphipods, so other marine invertebrates that are found in the water column. So they'll be able to determine where the amphipods are found, you know, how deep they're having to go or how shallow, and if they're moving along the coast. So that's a good source of information for helping us to explain what's going on.
And is there a place where all of this information lives if people want to track how many dead whales wash ashore, what the progress of the investigation is? Is there a way we can find that?
Yeah, so NOAA has a website for all their unusual mortality events. For this one, if you just type in gray whale, UME, NOAA, it should come up. And there's all sorts of information. Last I checked, it was 105 whales, and that's along the entire coast from Mexico all the way to Alaska.
And what about support from the state government or the federal government?
So that it is run, the investigation is run by NOAA. And when you say support,
well, like,
you mean funding support?
Like all of the scientists that are out there doing this important work.
There is very little funding support. Most of this work is done by nonprofits like the Marine Mammal Center and the Academy of Sciences all along the coast. I mean, there are marine mammal stranding networks throughout Washington and Oregon and Alaska that are all working together.
Very little funding. Is that under various administrations or just this one?
Typically under various administrations. Hmm. There's a certain amount set aside each year that people have to apply for. This unusual mortality event does make more funds available, more for things like diagnostic testing and sample analysis and things, not for the actual going out to the animal as much.
What could you do if the federal government decided that this was an issue they needed to start funding?
We could do a lot more testing, and we could bring in more people to do the analysis and do the work. Yeah. What about?
Mm-hmm. It's important to note here that, you know, that we are nonprofits, and we really rely on our community to support this work. So when we talk about it, all the things that we've talked about today, it's because we have supporters in the community that want us to do this and want to help us do this, and we get the authorization and the permission and partner with the federal agencies to do all of this work. But really, without the desire of our communities and our supporters and our donors, none of this work would happen. And that's why we can't rely on the government to do this. It's very important work. It's definitely a partnership, but it's also we also rely on the public to support us to do this work.
Right. And same question to you, Sean. If people want to track the number of sick and starving sea lions and seals, where can they find that information?
On our website at the Marine Mammal Center, .org, we maintain a page of all the animals that we've rescued, give some basic information about them when they're released. That's in there. There are opportunities to become a member at the Marine Mammal Center, and you'll be able to get more information and invites to releases and private tours. We rescue a lot of animals. We're over 700 rescues this year. Based on the pace that we're rescuing animals, we'll definitely be over 900 and closer to 1,000, I think, for the year. Mm-hmm. So it's each individual animal, we try to provide as much information as we can, but our website is really the best place to understand what's happening this year and what species and what problems that we're dealing with.
And what would you say, final question to both of you in our remaining minutes, what would you say needs to be done to stop this trend? I know you said that we've seen this before, but this is happening very, very quickly. What would you say? What can we do to stop this?
I think as individuals, we need to do as much as we can to conserve and reuse and eliminate our use of single-use plastics and all of the things that are really dangerous for this planet.
I think the most important thing is that we continue to learn and collect data and do research. All the things we've talked about would not be possible without people donating money to the Marine Mammal Center, to the Cal Academy of Sciences, and demonstrating to our government that this is important work and that we need to continue to fund it from that angle as well. That's the number one thing, is we have to take action ourselves. The second one is you can make individual choices. One of the easiest ones is what you eat that comes from the ocean, and making sure that it's from a sustainable source, because the more that we deplete our fisheries, the harder it's going to be for the ocean to thrive. Mm-hmm.
Dr. Sean Johnson is Director of Veterinary Science at the Marine Mammal Center in Sausalito. They're dedicated to the rescue and rehabilitation of ill and injured marine mammals. Mo Flannery is the Birds and Mammals Collection Manager at the California Academy of Sciences, a science museum and scientific and educational institution. And if you're in the area, I hope you can take the time to visit both of these incredible organizations. Mo and Sean, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you can find more information about this issue at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss the epidemic of gun violence in the U.S. We will dig into what we know about the radicalization of young white male shooters. We'll talk about white supremacy and the connections to Donald Trump's racist rhetoric. What can we do to truly take on this epidemic of violence? Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And if you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. And be sure to sign up for our podcast and leave us a review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call's One Planet series.